to Depth of Field with Tim Bradstreet and Tom Racine. Thanks, Gun Planet. It's about freaking time.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tim Bradstreet Experience Podcast. I'm Tom Racine, your sort of host guy, and I'm here with Tim, wow, back face to face. He's not in the high desert of New Mexico anymore. He's actually back, and we are here to talk with a wonderful little gentleman whose name, I believe, is Jim Daly. You probably know him as the comic book artist for Bad Planet. We have him here live with us in the studio, and we are three men and two mics, so we apologize in advance. Tim, how you doing, man?
Pretty good. Going to be playing some kissy face with Jim here near the mic.
I know. It's very exciting. Yes. We're going to have the live web broadcast on cam here in just a little while so you guys can watch. So welcome back, man.
Hey, thanks, baby. I'm actually wearing clothes, too.
I know. And you're this time you're clothes. That's right. Last time, one of the last times we talked, you were in a hotel room naked with some Brazilian hot models, I believe you said.
That's right. That's right.
I didn't believe you then. I don't believe you now.
The problem was Alcock was only envisioning me nude.
That's right.
And what he wasn't envisioning was the entire picture.
That's right.
But I straightened him out on that. He's you know, everyone's a homophobe at heart, right?
Yeah, especially a guy named Alcock. I mean, come on. Yeah. Give me a break.
So. He's got to be very protective of.
Yeah. Well, we might get to some dark country stuff later. We actually will be hopefully be talking to Mr. Thomas Jane. The reality is this may be posted after that, so I don't know when this is going to be. But we're going to talk to Thomas Jane. We also have a brief interview with the man himself, Ron Perlman, which was really, really exciting for me. I got to talk to him while he was on the set. Man was wonderful. How was he in person? What was that like?
I wish I could have seen your face while you were talking to him, because I know you were anticipating that with great gusto.
Especially it was like at 1 in the morning. It was 3 in the morning for you guys.
We stretched you out as far as we could. You know, I set that up with Ron earlier, and you know, as time kept clicking by, you know, and I did call you at one perfect time, and you weren't available.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Ron had scenes to do, and we got, you know, finally back to a place. You know, I had to keep needling him. You know, I was like, come on, man, we got to do that thing now. Come on.
He's got the deepest voice on the planet. He sounded, I mean, the guy, what you said, he came from 127 straight days of shooting in, what, Czechoslovakia, was it, or something like that?
He was in Prague and Budapest.
And this is like one of those easy shoots where he's covered in full body makeup and you know, 6 hours worth of, you know, prosthetics. It was a simple shoot.
127 days of shooting, and 107 of those he was in full makeup.
That's amazing to me. And then he still flew directly from there to New Mexico to do this 4 or 5 day shoot. The guy's a monster.
He basically finished shooting Hellboy one day, got on a plane the next day, and came straight to Albuquerque to start working with us, which I can't tell you how much. That was huge.
That's amazing.
Huge of him to do for us.
It's amazing. The guy's obviously one of those just loves what he does kind of guys. And it was great. We had a little talk. I didn't talk to him. I didn't get him for very long, and I didn't want to bore him with the billion questions he's going to get about Hellboy, so hopefully people will find that vaguely interesting. But enough of that, because we have an interesting guy here. We have Mr. Jim Daly. I'll let you talk about him just for a second, because you've worked with him. He's the penciler for the Bad Planet, which number 4 just came out, people. Even though it's not on the website, we have all sorts of reasons that happened. But it is available, Bad Planet number 4. So tell me about Jim Daly.
And feel free to come onto the forum, and we'd love to, while my cat has a big giant accident sliding all over my comic books.
That's right. There is a cat running around. I apologize.
We have a forum thread open on that right now, and we'd love to hear your feedback. We feel that this issue is kind of like finally, you know, everything's come together in terms of the printing and the paper and the color, which we had, you know, darkness issues with prior to this.
It's a kick-ass cover, I must say. I love that cover.
Hey, man, you can't, you, yeah, please. It's my favorite cover. No, actually, my favorite cover is probably Mark Schultz's, followed by Kaluta's. But yeah, I felt like I held my own with those guys. Now, Jim Daly is a guy I've known for, geez, Jim, how long have we known each other? 15 years, something like that, since you were a fan, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, since I was 18.
Yeah, and we met at, did we meet at Detroit or Chicago?
Chicago Con, I think 1990. I came down on a bus with some people from, believe it or not, my church went to the Chicago Comic Con on a bus, and I met you and Jimmy Palmiotti, which I think were the first two professionals who actually like looked at my crappy little sketchbook and, you know,
had positive things to say.
Yeah, or at least constructive
yeah
things to say.
Now, you were not you know, at that time, you weren't nearly the, you know, as polished as you are now, but definitely your stuff had, I remember, a lot of energy in that stuff. And did you meet Jim O'Barr at that same show?
I think I met, well, Jim O'Barr actually did the first, like, the, my first job in comics was for Everett Hartso, London Night Studios. And
may he rot in hell.
No comment. But James did the cover to that, and then I didn't meet him until like 2 or 3 years later in Detroit through you. You introduced me to him there.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, Jim came over to my table. This is funny. Daly's heard this story before. He's not offended. But O'Barr came over to my table, and he goes, man, did you know there's a couple of guys here ripping you off? And I go, what do you mean? They stole money out of my, off my table? He's, no, no, no. Stylistically, their artwork, they're ripping you off, man. They're nice guys, but they're, you know, they're kind of, geez, you know. So he takes me over and he shows me Jim Daly, and I was like, come on, O'Barr. I'm like, they're not really, come on. It was Jim Daly and Kyle Hoetz.
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, well, not the fact that your style is pretty powerful, that you were also a mentor and everything. I was certainly influenced, and Kyle's work is, I think, as much influenced by you as it is, like, say, Kelly Jones or Bernie Wrightson.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But the stark high contrast stuff. And
totally.
I mean, everyone starts somewhere. I guess I could have started, you know, being more influenced by Neil Adams or something if I had met him. You
exactly.
Know,
but, you know, and I mean, by the same token, I was influenced by, you know, like Gene Day and Paul Gulacy and Jim Steranko and guys like that. And that's kind of where I was coming from. So it wasn't like I, you know, kind of came up with this. But anyway. Jim and I have known each other for a long, long time and became pretty good friends over the years going to these shows. And it was perfect timing. We ran into you in Dallas, and Tom was actually at that show, but he didn't really look at your stuff, as I recall.
Actually, no. Tom, I think I showed you the stuff after because you were pretty busy, as your table's usually pretty packed. But Tom came by after, I believe it was Scott Harbin or something, sent him over, and Tom liked some of the sketches I had at the booth, and then I showed you later on.
You showed me the Good Green Earth stuff, the new style you were working in.
Yeah, I was really heavily influenced by European comic artists like Adamov and Mobius and Serpieri, and I want to say, I don't want to say this name wrong, but I think it's Bilal.
Yeah, Inky Bilal, yeah.
And
me too.
Yeah, much more like highly rendered, more detailed, more textural stuff, and that was the work I had there. So Tom saw it, but I talked to you much more about it.
Well, I was blown away by that stuff, especially your big splash page with the gal on it. But it was still a couple months before I kind of put two and two together. I thought, you know, in talking to you, like, since that show, it occurred to me that you work in a lot of styles, and that what all we really needed to do was see if we could, see if we could get you to come close to what we were trying to do with Louis LaRosa, because we didn't want this shock of styles. You know, replacing a penciler is a tough thing, and we were faced with the fact that, you know, we had this really incredible artist with Louis LaRosa, and you know, he left for reasons that we've explained and explained, but left us halfway through an issue, and we had to have someone come in there and you know, try to ape the style somewhat, which you did admirably. In fact, there is a couple pages there that you and Louis worked on, and you can't tell where he stops and you start.
Yeah, there was like issue 2. I think I got I can't remember the page. It was page 2. There was a creature that needed to be changed, and then there was a page with a few panels that were unfinished, and I think the cool thing was that I actually picked up Bad Planet at the comic book store because obviously you were working on it, and it was the first time I saw you inking anything in a while, and Lewis's art was just spectacular. And then of course, like everyone else, I kind of waited for the next issue, and then it didn't
never,
come out.
Yeah, which never came till you showed up.
Which is kind of cool because I feel like obviously the, you know, putting the most high quality work I could possibly put into it was necessary because I was a fan of the book before I got to work on it. But one of the things I worked a lot more in video games than I have in comics for the last 10 or 15 years, and the requirements there are having to switch from project to project and work in either a cartoony style or a, you know, realistic style. And since obviously I'm familiar with your work, and then looking at Lewis, it was not as slow a transition as I thought it would be. I think by the time end of issue 3 or 4, I think I felt like I could accomplish that stuff.
Well, it's easier too. I think it's necessary for me as an inker that all the nuts and bolts are there, so to speak. You know, it's got to be. You know, because you know me, I need. I like tight pencils. I prefer to work with tight pencils, and but you know, the look that I'm then throwing on top of it is it's changed since the beginning of the book. Lewis didn't really use a lot of textures. Now we're using them all over the place, but we kind of had this really great transition into it. It was slow, and it was, you know, it wasn't forced. It just kind of evolved into it. So now we're kind of, you know, towards the end, I think, and you really kind of hit your stride, I think, on issue 4, issue 5, and issue 6 is just spectacular. I mean, and that's not to sell any of your earlier work short. It's just that we both started to find a rhythm with this thing and kind of get a feel for each other, and it's just gone to great places.
Did you feel any sort of pressure in having to copy Lewis's work early on, and did you feel you had to put your own self down a little bit and then let it come through by the following issues, or did you feel any of that kind of pressure? Either mic is fine.
Which mic do I go to?
Well, certainly, because, you know, I mean, because I started to hit the ground running, you know, I mean, it wasn't like I had 2 or 3 months to kind of perfect the style, so, I mean, part of it was... You know, trying to the quality of Lewis's work, the quality of that book was higher than anything I've seen before. And oftentimes you do comics and you get a month to do 22 pages. And I think that the nice thing is that, you know, maybe the deadlines, us working ahead before this book was released again, allowed me to spend more time on this stuff and then spend more time with Tim kind of perfecting but just trying to get the style down. And Tom is a huge fan of quality artwork, so it was very I think that it's good, though. It's good to be challenged and to, you know, have someone keep you on your toes all the time, because you'll do better work.
So. That's right. Yeah, and you know, in many ways, early we were trying to, you know, find ways to raise the game, you know, and you actually, Jim did actually have kind of a breakdown at one point. But I say, you know what? Why hide the truth?
Let's hear about that. What was that all about?
I think there was a page that had like...
It was a full page. That full page in issue 3.
A spider, and it must have taken me 3 or 4 days. And I had moved out here specifically to like work on this. There was... I normally work in video games, and the person I was with at the time, she wanted to move back to San Diego, so we did that. And so there was some pressure in the personal department to kind of make sure all this was working, and I was really struggling. I think that was the middle of issue 3.
You were stressing out, yeah.
And I was like, I just felt like I wasn't getting it, or I wasn't getting to the point where each page was becoming more and more successful than the last. And I think we had a long conversation where I was definitely freaking out about whether or not I could even, like, keep going,
because yeah.
It was
pretty tough too, because you know, Jim said to me, you know, I can't be Lewis LaRosa, and the reason he said that is because, you know, we were asking him to change faces and stuff like that. And when we first started the book, when Jim and I first started to communicate about this thing, everyone's very open to, and Jim's very open to, hey, if you need me to change something, if you need me to do this, you just tell me what you need to do. And so I kind of took, at the beginning, an art director kind of detached kind of this was a learning experience for me too. So I kind of detached myself and just tried to be a straight art director and forget the fact that Jim and I are friends. So I sent him an email about some changes I wanted, and it was very kind of short. One might even say curt.
Yeah, it was curt for sure.
It was no.
Hey,
it was,
Kurt.
Hey, Kurt. That's a private joke. But that. And I didn't hear back from, I think Jim answered the email and he was very friendly and everything, but little did I know he was having some issues with the way that went. And after I went back and Jim and I talked about it and I reread it, I was like, oh yeah, well, okay, well, I learned something there. And
don't start off your emails with, dear asshole.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and but that was great, because you know, when Jim and I finally did talk and I found out how, you know, hard of a time he was having with it all, I was able to then say to him, you know what, forget everything we talked about and just remember that on top of everything, this is your book. And I think that was something that was kind of liberating for him.
Yeah, absolutely. Once you, because you, again, like, you know, Tom, like you said, I mean, you have pressure. I'm not only trying to do work that's impressing my friend and someone I respect as an artist, but also Tom and Steve's script had delivered the best possible story, you know, and everything. And I think that that break came from, in my head, I think it came from the fact that I've worked for so long in games under direction from people who, I mean, it's sometimes it's micromanagement, right? Down to like things
where extreme micromanagement. Yeah,
it can be ridiculous. And I, where I work now is a much better place. But all that was leaving games and going to do this. I guess maybe part of it was I'm going to get a little more leeway. But once you told me that, I felt sort of empowered, and then it almost started to just happen naturally. I wasn't thinking about it anymore. I was just doing it in pages where I was doing almost a page a day after that up until February when I started
at the new place.
Yeah, and it was just pouring out. So
well, and you did, I think, you know, one of the wonderful things that Jim did post this conversation, because I don't think the convict had really showed up yet, was Jim really defined our main character in this book. He really nailed the character in terms of his face and his skin and his and all the little things that make the convict the convict. I've had such a joyous time working on some of those heads, you know, like just laying in. And the cool thing is Jim pencils very tightly, but he's also not offended when I kind of go off on my own tangent and I add a lot here or there wherever I kind of feel it or see it, which has been fantastic.
Was it any different working on issue 3 because it was 3D? Did that affect how you were laying things out, or does the printing process have any restrictions on you or anything like that?
One of the things that was nice is in the script, Tom and Steve had indicated what things were coming out of the panels, etc. And once I finished up the half of issue 2 that Lewis did not complete, the
klaxon.
hey, this is coming up. Be prepared to get a little bit crazy with the panel design. And even pages that in the script weren't indicated as 3D should all have those elements, like characters leaping out of the panels or more montage-like compositions. So the first half of the issue, I really had to like think... I really like to tell the story inside a panel box. Like, you're watching a film and you don't see Bruce Willis's head come up out of the widescreen frame. So everything is told within that. And so I think issue 3, not only did it, like, it was a lesson in doing comics for 3D so that Raizone knew that grenade was coming out of the panel, and I think that's one of the most successful pages where that thing is just coming out at you. But in issues after that, I continued to do that and continued to mess with the storytelling and continued to bring the characters in and out of the panels and do different layouts and stuff that I would have never done before, instead of keeping it really basic or keeping it to a grid. So
yeah, and the cool thing was, too, is like sometimes, no matter, and I'm not saying this about you, but sometimes no matter how good you think you got it down, it's really nice to, and a lot of times it's forced on you, to kind of strip away all your habits and have to try to conform yourself to a different set of rules, which I think is what you're saying, and you actually just ended up embracing it and then bringing it to, you know, that same kind of thought process to other issues, which was nice.
I was almost forced myself now to break the rules, or, you know, that's what it was. It was like something that, like, if you look at people who are aspiring comic artists, people who've studied the Image comics, like Todd McFarlane's layouts, and he was one of those guys that just went crazy with the layouts, and sometimes some of those books have more pinups than they do have storytelling or backgrounds, and so I see a lot of that from guys who show their work. It's like, well, it's people popping out of panels, and they're not concerned about the storytelling. And I think I was always very strict with myself and saying, well, storytelling is first. And yeah, I'm sure Wolverine would be great if his arms were climbing up all over the panel borders, but I'm going to stay inside and make sure the story comes first. And in this case, they were actually forcing me to be a little more graphic, and ended up, I have way more fun. There's some pages in issue 4 that I look at and years ago I would never even tried to do that, and then I think that my storytelling has improved vastly because of
to
it.
Your benefit, embracing that helped out a lot.
I mean, that's got to be true of almost pretty much any artist. If you get forced outside your comfort zone, it always makes you better. I mean, this is all there is to it, because you get into your little ruts, and if you're a musician or anybody, and so it's great to have somebody pushing you down a different road.
It can help.
And in this case, it was Tim Bradstreet. I would like to... Well,
luckily, we had, around that same time, Tom and Steve came down to visit. Now, this was right after... What had they done? They'd gone out to...
Burning Man.
So they were very burnt when they showed up, and they were hurting. But we had a nice chance to sit down, talk about the 3D, how we wanted to attack it, and straight from Tom, face to face, get an idea of exactly kind of what where he was coming from, and kind of a nice place to kind of launch yourself and in preparation for starting that issue.
He showed me a book of plants that were done in that stereoscopic, or I don't know, what's
that book is nuts too.
And everything has to be at a 45 degree angle, so you put it on the table and you look back and then everything stands up properly. So one of the things that Tom was indicating to me, and then the first page of the 3D issue, even though it's not in 3D, has one of the main characters, Anan, is sitting in a chair, and we're almost at a isometric three quarters above him. I don't know if isometric is the right word, but isometric.
That distance
isotopes
is perfect for you.
Okay. Hi. And so I kind of tried to make sure that the things that I was drawing were in perspective, either from a lower angle or from a higher angle, or something that they could, pop out. There's a page where they're looking up at a computer screen, and there's a Bedouin who's come in to translate some Egyptian text.
That one of the faces I didn't like that I ended up
loving. Yeah, he hated the guy in the turban.
Yeah, I was like, he's too cartoony, man. Come on.
He was a little cartoony.
But it turned out really good.
So I definitely want to point you to his website, which is a website. You can tell us if there's other ones, but the www.jmd3.com, which has incredible amount of work. A lot of his concept art, illustration, sketchbook, all his comic book work, storyboards, and things like that. I was looking through it. I don't know your exact resume, but it shows that you've worked on various card games for Fleer. You've done comic books for Marvel. You've done a bunch of stuff with some DC guys. What was it like working on the card games? Because that's something that you've got a very limited space, but it looked like it was a pretty creative venue. I mean, what was that like working on all those card games?
Well, the first card game I worked on was for White Wolf, which was the Rage card series, which is all vampires and vampires and werewolves, and that was pretty easy because those guys, as much as they are, I think probably one of the biggest publishers of pen and paper RPGs, they almost just said, here's the description, draw a really cool vampire and go.
Yeah, they started out giving people a lot of freedom on that stuff, mainly because I didn't want to take any direction on that, especially with vampire. But they got a good set of art directors in there, and they did let guys run, and then they'd go out and get guys like John Van Fleet and
Leif Jones.
Yeah, Leif Jones and some fantastic. Leif Jones is great.
Yeah, he's awesome.
So they learned something very early on, which was if we don't try to hit them over the head with the concept and we just give them something to absorb, they can run with it and create some incredible stuff for us. And everyone should take that lead.
Well, they let me experiment with different styles. I think that the reason that they hired me in the first place was because I had heavy influences of Tim's work, and clearly he had laid the groundwork of that company to begin with. I mean, it's a signature. I still see people wearing those T-shirts now. But the Fleer stuff was much different. It was Marvel, I haven't worked for Marvel in years, but they were, while I was working for them, they're notorious for throwing something at you and say you had 2 weeks to do 22 pages or... And since Marvel owned Fleer at the time and they were all Marvel cards, it was, here's 15 or 20 cards that need to be, illustrated, pencil, ink, color, in a week. And it's not like they're difficult things because it's a smaller illustration, but the descriptions and the editing on it and everything was really, it was difficult. And I don't think any of those cards really came out how I wanted them to. There was a Deathlock one that came out pretty cool, but I did one of the Scorpion, the
Deathlock,
the Spider-Man villain Scorpion, and I had never really had anything in Wizard magazine unless it was an advertisement for a book I worked on. Never like a piece of art or anything like that. But in the back of Wizard, like say 1996, the drawing I did of Scorpion, his tail is coming out at you in perspective, and it almost looks like he's taking a shit, like a big giant green. And they made fun of it and put the card in there. So.
Oh, what jerks! It's so easy for them. It's so easy to make fun.
And now,
I thought that was cool.
And now a lot of the work you do is video game stuff now. And how long have you been doing that kind of stuff? And what's the difference in the way it's approached in your sort of traditional illustration?
Before we get into that, Jim Daly used to, you did finishes, right, on Ghost Rider? Ashley Wood back in the day.
Yeah, the first Marvel gig I got was inking Ashley Wood on Ghost Rider 2099, taking over for Kyle Hotz's run. And he lived in Australia, like in Perth at the time. So I got a cover in the mail to ink and one page on paper. And after that, and the editors never knew this at the time, except for our editor, but none, like Bobby Chase didn't know about this, but, you know, Cavalieri knew what we were doing, but Ashley was faxing me layouts, and I would blow them up and then finish them on board. But it was nice to actually work over his pencils at first, but it took so long to ship the pages at that time that there was no way that we could have kept a deadline. So I would just take these crappy faxes and blow them up and finish them. And
the work you go through when you're young and hungry, man, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I think we did 10 issues of Ghost Rider 2099. By the last issue, Ashley had left the book, and I had to... it was a double-sized issue 25 or something, and I had to pencil and ink the whole thing. So that was the first time anybody at Marvel gave me a chance to pencil. So
I'd like to see that, too. I don't think that I've ever seen that issue.
You really don't want to see it. But okay, sure.
Yeah, bring it over, man.
Well, then I have to ask, did you see Ghost Rider the movie? And what did you think?
Well?
No comment.
I thought it was total shit, actually. I thought that, I mean, it seems like it could have been played well. And by the way, Sam Elliott usually rules in anything he's in, so that's always a joy to watch him act on screen. But Nicolas Cage, he seems like he could have played it closer to his chest, a little more Bruce Willis than John Travolta there, and make it a little more serious picture instead of a...
The Snake Eyes performance out of him.
Oh, my God.
I didn't think he'd ever work again after that movie. I love Nick Cage, but he I don't know of any actor, A-list kind of actor, that can bomb so completely horribly and still have an A-list career. He still comes back and does... I mean,
he is one of those guys you think, God, he was brilliant, or, oh, man, what was he doing?
Well, you know it's like what was the Two Towers movie that he did? World Trade Center. Yeah. I thought he was great in that.
Well, he's a fantastic actor, and I don't know if Ghost Rider was a paycheck for him. I know he's a comic fan. I know that he's auctioned off his collection before, so he's associated with comics. Him and his son are working on a comic.
Yeah, yeah.
So you think he'd have some respect for the material, and maybe it wasn't all him. And I will say that in saying the movie was total shit, I think the story was crap. But the effects on Ghost Rider and the motorcycle were awesome. If they could have, you know, actually had some glue of a story in between those things, it might have actually...
Well, that's one of the things I go off on now every summer. It's like I'm kind of sick of people saying, "Yeah, but the effects were really cool." It's like I don't want to see good effects. Well, good effects are easy now. That's not the point.
The bike looked great. There's no question about that. And that's unfortunately, you know, that movie made a ton of money because of the 15 to 20 year olds. And this is what I say on the website all the time. I'm like, don't go support crap because they'll keep feeding it to you. And Ghost Rider is definitely a good example of that. Well, you know, at least with Fantastic Four, the first movie was so completely, I can't even talk about it. And I haven't seen the second one, but from all the people I've talked to, at least it's a better animal. But you know, it's like, it doesn't matter how cool the bike is. They never got the skull right. The skull looks like some clean piece of plastic. It's terrible, and it should be the best thing about that character.
Somebody should have been looking at Mark Teixeira comics and saw how beat up it was.
Well, who's the guy that does the cover for him? Covers for him? He did a little run of covers on Ghost Rider. Crane?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Clayton Crane.
Clayton Crane? Yeah. He's amazing. Yeah. They should have been looking at his work.
happen.
I'm gonna find that guy, and he's gonna do some Raw covers.
All right, so turn into your video game stuff. Now, what's it like? Is there a different process in video games in terms of like the cards you've worked on, the comic books? How much freedom do you have? How many restraints do you have? What's that process like?
Well, the restraints are getting better now because next generation technology and the way they can make things look in 3D has allowed concept art to actually almost be virtually translated from a piece of paper or a painting into the actual model that runs around the game.
No more ponytails plated to the back of their heads.
Well,
because
unfortunately,
they can't flow free.
There's no really great way to do hair or cloth yet consistently. Yeah, I'm sure. Give it like 2 years.
Yeah, give it two more minutes and it'll be there.
But the restriction is always the technology and then the design. So I mean, you can design a six arm character, not a giant tentacle monster or something like that. But I think that the difference between working on, like, say, Bad Planet with Tim and Tom Steve is that it seems more it's close knit. Like we're communicating, and there isn't.
You don't have to have 20 meetings before you, yeah.
Right, yeah, there's one conversation. Tom wants a monster that looks like a set of balls that attacks people, and then I do several sketches, and then we usually go through it with something like a big $13 or $30 million video game project. There's such a long process of getting that design right, especially if it's supposed to be an aspirational fantasy. You want to drive this character around for 30 hours or however long the game plays. So those characters have to just grab you, and you want to, you not only want to play the guy, but you want to be the guy, and you have to interact. And so I think the pressure of making some kind of, I guess you want to say, intellectual property, even if it's a licensed property, there might even be some more pressure there.
Let me tell you too that in this kind of ties into Bad Plan a little, well, very much so, is that because of Jim's experience as a conceptual artist working in video games, it made the process of coming up with a lot of these characters that we have in the book, whether it's aliens or environments or spaceships or weapons. A wonderful experience because I made a joke on the forum or somewhere that Tom would make a comment like that urinal on the prison asteroid. It's a little too sterile. I want something a little bit, I want it to be all steel instead of porcelain. And then Jim would send back eight drawings of a urinal, like from everything from filigree to he just sent us eight versions of this stuff, and it's like every character Jim would just go in and attack, and like the battle suit, we got like eight versions of that battle suit, all with different configurations and different designs and that's something you don't I know a lot of guys who draw books, because I see a lot of like working on the Punisher, I'll see like Lan Medina's designs for this new character, but it's usually relegated to, a front shot, a side view, and this is the guy, kind of character sheet. And the stuff that and I can't wait for this thing to go into trade paperback so people can actually see all your concept drawings. Because that was a real boon for us as publishers, as art directors, is to have a guy that's got those kind of chops. That was really awesome, babe.
Well, thank you very much. I think that the most fun part was that there were original creatures to design, like the Molian, which is my favorite.
The Molian.
It's like a little, I don't know, it's Molian.
He's in the book for like a page and a half, and Jim just had a ball drawing this guy.
Well, one of the things in doing concept work for games is there's so much iteration on a theme, or you go through, start doing silhouette, just basic silhouette drawings to, at a distance, what does it look like? And my best example would be like a TIE fighter. If you just black it out in silhouette or Mickey Mouse's head, you know what it is. It's sort of iconography. And so we work constantly, like 2 or 3 days in a row, of just pumping out iterative work, ideation on characters and armor and vehicles until something is picked. So he's kind of, over the years, been trained to produce as much or as many options as possible. And I'll say that while there were like maybe 8 or 10 drawings, I mean, in video games, there could be 50 drawings,
sure,
60 drawings in a week, and maybe two of them, maybe the first two you get picked, and maybe what goes on in comics a lot. And I noticed, and it doesn't make sense to me that you can't have more complex looking characters that people just don't want to have to draw them on deadline from different angles with complex armor. So you get someone like, say, Alan Davis, who will do some pretty complex science fiction characters, but it's a lot of smooth lines, and there's a lot of tight costumes and tight outfits. It's almost like they said, well, I did the first two drawings, and that's it. That guy. And I think maybe if they went further, or more people went further, you'd find more interesting shapes to mix together, more interesting design aspects to mix together to come up with just a better-looking character.
I won't do eight versions because I know that the first version I come up with is always going to be the best, Jim.
Of course.
Or maybe the second version. And you know, when I'm doing movie posters and designs and stuff like that, I never give them more than two choices because I might have seven versions and, you know, like five or six of them of which I hate, but I know that it'd be something they'd like. And I only ever show them two, and it would be limited to the two that I want to do. Because
is that the Mr. Scott theory? You know, how else do you keep your reputation as a miracle worker?
Exactly.
Only give them the two.
Well, you know, most of the people that are art directing you on those kind of levels, and in a lot of cases in comics, that they don't know crap about what we're doing. And it's like, you know what? I've done this for 20. You know, I'm playing art director with myself. I would never have even shown this to you if it hadn't already gone through 10 hours of fiddling, you know. And you get it to a point, and you're like, "That's it, man." You know when the magic's there.
I think every artist does. Maybe not. Maybe some of them don't have that intuition, but you feel it. And sometimes the first few sketches are so raw, I will use them. that like
dare you,
and they have everything that you thought of in your head, or they had the requirements based on the script or the character description, or maybe in the instance of Bad Planet, what Tom or Tim saw in their head plus what I saw, and then mixed it together, and there you have it. In games, I think I've found that, and this has happened several times in like the last few months even, where I've done maybe 30 or 40 drawings of a character, and the third drawing I did was the one everyone, you know, decided on to move forward with, because sometimes your energy or the intuition you have about it just happens just right away, and the rest is just exploration. Now it could go the other way too, and you just don't have a solution. And I think, and I want to say this so that it makes sense, is I think that it's fun to do character design, and it's fun to do draw monsters and everything, but maybe what people or people who want to do concept art don't understand is that it's at least 60%, 75% maybe even, just problem solving the requirements of the design of the game or the art director's, you know, requirements, plus, you know, the fiction or the personality of the character. So you do a lot of problem solving. Yeah, I can't have a guy who doesn't have a ponytail, what am I allowed to use and what can I do? And then you go over the edge first and then reel yourself back in. And that's if you shoot yourself in the foot and say you can't do all these things first, then you might not, I don't know, you might not find what you're looking for as quickly. You might just continue to iterate and subtle changes instead of being bold and just going completely crazy and then coming back, if that makes any sense.
It made sense to me.
Hey, you're boring me now.
No, that was good.
Good stuff, baby.
If you could do any project, if you had your pick of anything, graphic novel, comic book, video game, animation, what would you really want to be doing? Say you just, you know, somebody give you $1 billion, you can do whatever you want. What would be your dream?
Wait a minute, they're giving me $1 billion, but I still have to do something.
Still have to do something, sorry, yeah.
I really meant on Lycan.
Yeah, you know, to be honest, I'm a Marvel fan, so if it had to be a character that wasn't mine.
Nerd.
Yes,
he's a Marvel
really
nerd.
Like Spider-Man.
I think Ghost Rider's always been my favorite characters. I think I'd like to see Ghost Rider doing, just take Ghost Rider to the apocalypse. It's just him against monsters. There's none of this dual identity crap. Just make him this pure thing that just hunts down stuff. Something where it can be something really epic or sweeping. In terms of what I really want to do, I'd rather work with people who are coming up with their own original intellectual properties and trying to put something new out there I used to think I wanted to work on Star Wars, but not
you'd be
anymore.
Good at it.
Well, I love Star Wars.
Yeah, you'd be real good at it.
Would you want to get into movies in terms of, you know, working for like Weta or LucasArts, coming up with the next cool concept drawings? Because what you're doing with video games sounds like, if you look at the Star Wars sketchbook or the Lord of the Rings stuff, I mean, that's totally what those guys are doing. Is that something that really interests you?
Yeah, I'd love to work in film on some, you know, a movie that where you, you know, certain maybe not, I don't know. It would have to be something, you know, like science fiction or fantasy, where you do get to like be crazy and create monsters and environments and stuff. But yeah, absolutely, Weta would be amazing, because it's just the next step from, you know, comics are a way to tell or really just direct a movie on paper, and video games is another way, but it's not a passive experience; it's an interactive one. So those restrictions are almost completely removed when it's a film. I mean, there's the level of detail you can create with creatures and sets, even in movies, is unlimited. So
I don't think I could have articulated that. Very nice job, Jim. I could not have articulated that. I would have said, "Yeah, it's well, this
sure
is this."
I'm not articulate.
I was going to ask a question because I was looking through your stuff. I saw your Marvel stuff with Ghost Rider, and I started thinking, you know, when I grew up and wanted to be a comic book artist, when was the first moment for both of you? Now, your first gig where you suddenly went, oh my God, I'm doing this. I'm doing Ghost Rider. I'm doing Spider-Man, whatever it was. What was the first time you got paid to draw something that was like totally out of your childhood and you couldn't believe you were lucky enough to do it? We'll start with you.
I'd have to say it was when I got a call from Ashley Wood and I was going to ink Ghost Rider, because at the time I was working full-time, either one or two full-time jobs just to afford to fly to every convention and meet editors or meet people and show my portfolio. So
you weren't really working professionally at that time?
Well, I was still getting paid, but it wasn't the only thing I was doing. Right. Well, it didn't pay my rent completely. So I think I was working at Kinko's, and the day I said Kinko's. I made more in one day, you know, doing three pages of Ghost Rider inks than I make all week, then I'm doing it. Okay, mm-hmm. You know, like I'm going to go home and do that. Yeah.
Cool. And Jim, when was your first time when you suddenly realized that, hey, the childhood dream, you just hung up the phone with somebody or you went, oh my God, I'm going to do this?
My first time, it was kind of painful.
I was shy.
You know, I've had many cases of that where I felt I had to pinch myself. You know, doing an Iron Maiden cover was one of those. But the first time that I think it really kind of got sent home on me was, I really want to say Hellblazer, and because there's a story behind that. But honestly, I would say getting a chance to do covers for The Unknown Soldier was one of those, because I was such a fan of Joe Kubert's Unknown Soldier when I was growing up. Before that, I can backpedal. Working with Tim Truman, my God. I mean, I remember walking out to the mailbox and pulling a package of Dragon Chang pencils out of there and walking in and looking at them and going, I can't believe I'm working with the guy that I worship. You know, I mean, it really boggled my mind.
You're living the dream, man.
Yeah, but, you know, the Hellblazer thing, too, was one of those situations where I worked in a comic shop when Hellblazer first started to come out, those gorgeous Dave McKean covers. And I was a huge fan of that book from day one. And when I became the regular artist of that same book doing the covers, that was really special. So it's hard to pick one. I feel like that all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a damn cool business you get to be in. So that's kind of nifty. Okay. Now I'm going to do the Mutual Admiration Society. What is the single favorite piece of work that you've seen Mr. Bradstreet do?
It's a Hellblazer cover, and I don't know what issue it is, but there's a girl and a kid, and you used some birds in the composition, and it's, I don't know what issue cover it is.
It's like 201 or 202, I think.
Yeah, she's wearing black, and there's a girl. It's one of my favorite compositions.
Oh, cool, man. Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome.
And now your turn. And you can't say Bad Planet, because that's just cheesy. Because right, I'm looking over here, literally 3 feet is the pencils to issue 6, and goddamn, they're cool.
Well, one of my favorite pieces.
What's your favorite Jim Daly?
One of my favorite pieces of Jim's is a piece that I really, really want to ink, and he gave me the pencils to it. Unfortunately, he drew it on sketchbook. notebook paper. So it's one of those things that I'm going to have to probably do over a light box. I still haven't done it yet. I've got the original from Jim, and it's the gas mask guy.
Yeah, it's on Strathmore paper, but it should take the ink, but
it's also like cut out too, so it's not like it's sitting in the middle of a page. It's like a I'm not going to ink on that thing. I mean, as an original, I wouldn't. You know what I mean? And I also kind of want to keep your pencils so you can have them back. But
I don't want them back.
Jim drawing in that style, and this is the real crime today, is that during the course of Bad Planet, and part of the reason for this is because the video game company that Jim worked for in Austin before he moved to San Diego robbed him of.
It was a vacation tie. I only worked there for 3 months, so I mean, in some way, it was a partly personal situation, but there was some vacation time owed to me, and it didn't really come through. And
it was promised, but not delivered.
Right, and the company that I work for now, actually, I had interviewed initially with. I actually was out here in San Diego for a few days, and I called Tim a couple times. And eventually, at the end of the airport. Because the interview went really well, and I was going to come out and work for the studio, and it ended up taking about 3 months to kind of negotiate an offer. And by then, I was going to move out here anyway. And having hooked up with Tim and Tom at the Dallas Con, and at San Diego Con, because initially you had called me about doing the Lycan first, and then asked me after that if I wanted to cut my teeth and. On Bad Planet with you guys and kind of show you what I could do there. And then after Bad Planet was done, move into the Lycan. So to me, it was just, no matter what, it was going to be a solid maneuver to come out here. But, you know, eventually I did realize that one of the great things about working in video games and is that, you know, there are a lot of benefits and in terms of, you know, there's 401k and there's, you know, stability.
Medical insurance.
And I'm not going to say that supersedes the fact that it is also very enjoyable and I do love doing it. But I did have to get back into doing that. And that's prevented me from actually working on the Lycan, which was something we talked about for a few weeks. And that's what got me excited about working with Tim to begin with. Not only just because, and I'm not going to be too mushy on you, but I mean, he's been my mentor and my brother for a very long time. So to be able to work with him, you know, and of course, Tom and Steve, who are well renowned and, you know, by themselves, but just to be able to learn more and work alongside Tim on something he was really, really passionate about, the Lycan, and the way he described it just on the phone. I mean, I could see it all in my head. So,
yeah, and I sent you the outline, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's getting back to it. The real crime of Jim Daly going back to work for the video game companies is he's just finished his last page of Bad Planet. What, last week?
Yeah,
week before. So he's done on Bad Planet, but he's now not got the time to do the project that I initially wanted to get him involved in, and that is the Lycan, and it's a period werewolf tale about a bunch of group of hunters. Like big game hunters from all around the world that during a squall have to land their ship into somewhere on the Ivory Coast. It's actually an island, and while there, the fiefdom that's there is under siege by these werewolves, and it all takes place in the early part of the 19th century, and it's absolutely a great project. Now, what Jim? The reason I'm so hurt. No, the reason it sucks so bad is what Jim did was he started to do a bunch of conceptual drawings of the characters in the style that was the reason I called him in the first place. This style that he's gotten to in his career, this personal, very personal style, which we asked him to avoid doing on Bad Planet so we could get a Louis LaRosa vibe. Now, the reason I just said that my favorite piece of Jim's is this gas mask guy is because it's done in that same style, that Good Green Earth graphic novel type stuff that you showed me.
More
and
European.
All these concept drawings are very, very similar. They're done in the same style. It's extremely illustrative. It's extremely textural. I just want to sink my teeth into that stuff. I mean, it's the stuff is just, and it's 180 degrees from what you're doing on Bad Planet, and it's very much more European style, influenced style. It's the kind of stuff that in the heyday of heavy metal, we could have gone there, got paid major bucks to do our our thing. And now, you know, it's unfortunate. We're not going to get to do that because we have to find someone else to do Lycan because Jim doesn't have the time.
You bastard.
Or you give me 2 years.
Yeah, or we give him 2 years, and that's kind of unfortunately.
To be honest, it takes, in some cases, it takes me less time to do that style. And then Tim really, and I feel a little stupid saying this, but I'm familiar with Bernie Wrightson, but not ever been familiar enough really with Franklin Booth or Joseph Clement Cole, which are two artists he showed me, which are, you know, clearly influenced Wrightson's Mary Shelley's stuff. And so that also was something we talked about too, and trying, because the stuff I was doing was more illustrative and textural and probably more European in the influence of it, that Franklin Booth, that illustration, you know, it would take some time to really give it love. Not that Bad Planet didn't take time, but it's such high contrast blacks and the details are, it's not Mignola simple, but it's simpler.
It's the kind of stuff that is just, you know, to render, you know, for you to do to a certain extent to where you feel comfortable leaving off on it, and then the work I do on top of it, very time consuming. And in essence, we're creating, it's not comic book art per se, as much as it is art.
It's much far more like
confined to panels and storytelling and all that, but at the same time, definitely several cuts above the norm. In terms of all that, it would. I honestly think that if we did this thing, it's a 6-issue series, it would be very remembered. It would be one of those really, really great books.
Which is why it's sad, because, you know, any artist's goal is to melt people's eyeballs if possible. And there's so much stuff on the shelves, and that's one of the great things about, I think, Ra's dedication to having. I mean, we have Michael Kaluta on a cover. We have, you know, Mark Schultz and people who are illustrators, Bernie Wrightson and Dave Stevens and
legendary illustrators.
And the
Basil Gogos.
Oh my God, that is so cool. Whatever.
No one's seen that yet, but we have a Basil Gogos cover that will be our trade paperback cover for Bad Planet.
But wouldn't it be nice that there was more quality or more, you know, to actually really try to be as the put the highest quality into the art, even if it takes a little longer for you to get those things. It's sometimes the monthly in and out of X-Men or whatever. I mean, and almost, you know, those artists, if they had 2 or 3 days to spend on a page, probably would just blow your mind. But they have, you know, 22 pages and 5 weeks to do it, and they've come up with a style that solves that issue for them, and it keeps them doing steady work. And I wonder sometimes if you look at some of them, even the most popular guys, like Jim Lee has a great style. One of the, you know, just it's comics when you look at his stuff. But I wonder if, you know, if that guy took 4 days to do a page, would it be ridiculously?
It takes him 4 days to do a page.
Oh, I didn't know that. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I think the Lycan, it's something where I think of like Barry Windsor Smith, or where you just look at the stuff and you're like, God, you know, I mean, he wasn't messing around, or he was really.
It's kind of like what you get, I guess, when
it.
You get a guy like Travis Charest, who, you know, he doesn't care about the deadline. He just does. And this is the way I've always looked at it too. Is like, even if I have a deadline, you know, and I've done something very ambitious with I've done something very ambitious with the composition and what this piece is going to be in the photographic stage when I kind of put everything together and go, okay, this is the cover. You know, I never think about how hard that work's going to be to do. And then I sit down and I'm like, what did I just... I mean, I just did a Punisher cover of this Vietnam thing with all these trees and all this stuff and these guys on patrol. And I had to have this thing done in 2 days. So I pretty much had to stay up for 2 days to get it done. I had to put the amount of work it was going to take to get it done into it and get it in on time. So I'm kind of like, I don't know where I'm going with that. But I never sacrifice that... You know, that quick way of doing it. You know, sometimes yes, I don't have any time to do something, and I have to have something in. So occasionally, like once in a blue moon, I will do a digital cover, and that saves me. But it's not like that happens in 8 minutes either. That'll be sometimes 2 days working on it.
That explained the classic comic book clip art book I see over there. Yeah.
Well, one of the things too that I guess it irritates me because not just because Tim is one of my closest friends or because I respect what he does, but I mean, there's so many people out there critics of his process, the way he does stuff. And I've sat here in the studio while I'm helping him ink something while he's working on one of these covers, and you can't just adjust levels in Photoshop and create. It's Every piece of it after the initial process of shooting that actor for that essentially that role or that illustration is just painstaking. I mean, even your method of transferring stuff blows me away. There's got to be a simpler way, my friend.
I loved seeing the look on your face when you finally realized that was part of my process.
Backwards, or I was like, "What the hell are you doing?" Like it was like rubbing a lottery ticket for 20 minutes.
Yeah. The dry transfer technique.
So yeah, anybody out there who feels like there's something quick and easy or something about this that is hackery to you, you're insane. And I think you should make a video time lapse of
bless
how that
you,
goes
Jim.
Down.
Bless you. Yeah,
we'll put it on YouTube. I've seen guys do that. I always have three words for those people. It's like, you try it.
Yeah. it always comes around. When I'm addressing my detractors, if it was so easy, why isn't everybody doing it? Yeah. And there's a lot more to it than simply taking a photograph and working from it. I use it as a base 9 times out of 10, unless it's a commercial gig or something like that. For comics, I experimented around a little bit with more of a commercial style occasionally, I got a lot of flack for it, and I believed in what I was doing, but. I just challenge these people to come and take a look, and you'll see that it's not as easy as you think it is, or it's not the shortcut that you think it is. I get mostly, like, if it's other professional artists digging on me, I without pretension, I say it's flat jealousy. screw them. So yeah. I don't really care about them. So.
Well, I come from more from a comic strip background, and one of the guys I do the other podcast with works at the Schultz Institute, and one of his jobs is they've been doing a lot of compilation books, and he has to recreate some of the artwork of Charles Schultz, and you'd think it'd be easy, yeah. And it's not. It's like that's not even anywhere near what we're talking about in complexity, but the simplicity of it is so difficult.
Stop
saying it's a couple of circles and a thing. If it was that simple, we'd all be doing it. So,
exactly. And I do have a lot of imitators, a lot of guys coming up, young guys coming up, trying to attempting to draw in that style, and giving it a good old college try. But You don't have to be a genius to tell the difference, in my opinion. But
the sincerest form of flattery.
Whatever. Let's get on to a better topic.
Well, actually, what we're getting on to is about the end of the show. We're 57 minutes in here. We've just been blabbing away. I think this has been great. I just want to remind people to take a look at Jim Daly's stuff at jmd3.com. Is there anything else you want to pump while you're here? Any other websites?
I think that website has a pretty good collection of stuff from over the years. I haven't updated it in quite some time. I just have some hosting problems.
Your MySpace page is pretty fun, too.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to say. The MySpace page has a lot of Bad Planet stuff up there.
Tutorial kind of. Well, it's not a tutorial necessarily, but it's a kind of, here's the process of Jim Daly penciling a page. And it's very informative for, I know we have a lot of younger artists at the Raw Forum, and I know that if they haven't already been pointed out to that, they should really go check that out, because it's a nice learning experience.
Yeah, I had fun doing that, and I just... it was such a specific process for Bad Planet because the pencils had to be so clean. And normally I would just pencil straight on the board after the layouts if I was doing the style that I normally work in. But really wanted to, I almost tried to how do you say, like, retro?
Retro,
I'm not even going to try it. I just tried to
say it like Chris Walken.
Wait, backwards engineer, right? Reverse engineer what Louis LaRosa was doing, because Tim had shown me a cover or some of his rough pencils, and then I looked at his finished pencils, and it almost seemed like he did all this rough sketching and all of his exploration on another piece of paper and then just traced it through
light boxed it.
So I was like, okay, I'm going to try doing that. And then so I just figured I would lay that out, and I thought it'd be fun to put up there. And the MySpace URL is myspace.com/JMDaily and the numeral 3.
Roman numeral 3? So three eyes?
No, just 3.
Oh, just, oh.
Like JMD3.
I don't have to know this because I have it saved as a favorite, so.
Or you can go to Tim's or Bad Planet's MySpace, and then I'm linked up there, too. Yeah. So.
Easy peasy. Japanesey.
All right. Well, thank you, Jim Daly, for talking to us. Really interesting stuff, and I'm telling you, your pencils are kicking ass. I'm looking at the issue 6 right now, and you people haven't seen it.
Everyone write
yet.
In and say you want Jim to do Like, and we have to change Tom's mind. That, you know, I honestly don't mind waiting for 2 years for Jim to do this book, and I keep going back to Tom going, hey, Tom, are you sure? You know, if we could do it in this, or is there any way we can trim it to 4 issues so Jim can do it, you know, inside of 2 years?
Well, obviously, Jim is under the delusion he still needs sleep, so I think we need to get him over that.
And Tom, I have to say, I mean, Tom is as enamored, as in love with the work that Jim did in those concepts for the Lycan as I am. So believe me when I say it hurts him to try to find. In fact, Jim's style on this thing has become the measuring stick for who we do get, to the detriment of me. I'm to the point where I really would love to have Daniel Zizej do it, but Tom's just not sold on him yet, you know, because he doesn't draw like Jim Daly. So,
well, I don't know what all the fuss is. You guys are talking about doing some kind of a comic book about moss. I don't get it. But we'll talk to you real soon. We'll be back, and then next week we have vast amounts of things to speak about. I'm sure we have movies, we have all sorts of stuff coming up. So, and there'll be more stuff on Dark Country being posted real soon.
Yeah, we might even have Jim back again, given the timing being right, because Jim in his continued good grace will occasionally take a Friday night out of his very busy schedule and come over here and help me ink backgrounds over his own pencils. It's kind of cool. We just get to hang out and just goof off all night and work. It's fun.
Cool. All right, folks, tune in again soon. Well, you know what? I have 2 movies that...
Should we do Battle Beyond the Stars? I honestly haven't been thinking about that since, but it's one of those movies that has a lot of people in it, you know?
All right, well, I'm going to distract you with another one that I actually don't even know this one.
Oh, please. Well, movie, I hope I've seen it.
Well, Jim suggested this one, Moon 44.
Moon 44. I know that Michael Paré's in it. That's about as far as I can go. I can't tell you anyone else who's in that movie. It's a movie that I maybe watched 10 minutes of.
There's someone you wouldn't think credited as an actor in that film, actually. Dean Devlin.
Ooh, Dean Devlin. Oh, that's right. Dean Devlin is in that. I do know that.
And
it slipped between my cracks.
There's somebody else in there, too, and I didn't know either, which is why I suggested it, because if I can't remember him, and I've seen that movie several times.
Yeah, Moon 44, go for a straight-to-video for me. Thank you. That helps. Jesus.
Lisa Eichhorn,
yeah.
Dean Devlin, Brian Thompson, Malcolm McDowell.
Lisa Eichhorn's in one of those Charles Bronson, it's not one of the Death Wish movies, but it's like a Death Wish movie that he did in the late 80s. Serial killer dude.
Yeah, Malcolm McDowell, he'll do anything.
Yeah, that guy's never done anything.
Yeah, who's that guy? All right, well then, Battle Beyond the Stars is the next one.
Did you have another? Do you have another one in your hip pocket?
No, I think it was that one. We did have Condor Man.
Condor Man, I wouldn't get anybody. Scott Speedman, who's in that? Battle Beyond the Stars. I told these guys, you know, they mentioned this earlier, and I went, oh, that's a great one, because I know a lot of guys from it. And then I started to list them off, and I went, stopped at 4, and I'm like, huh. Great. I thought I knew more guys than that.
What year?
Battle Beyond the Stars?
Yeah.
I'm going to say 83.
1980.
Yeah. Oh, wow, good.
my first year of high school.
You got me there. I think John Sayles wrote the screenplay for that.
Yes.
How about that? John Woo! Sayles, Lone
John
Star.
John Sayles.
I love John Sayles.
Lone Star is one of the best movies ever.
So let's see here.
All right, let's go down the task.
I'm going to start with Richard Thomas because everyone, you know, the guy with the birthmark on his cheek played the main character.
He's the first guy I would have thought of for an action sci-fi film. John Boy Walton.
Everybody was having that trouble when that movie came out. But you know what? It's a heap and help of fun. It's a heap and helping of fun is
a
what
heap
it is.
And helping of fun.
Sybil Danning.
I got to love Sybil Danning.
George Peppard.
Yep.
Who I always said peppered when I was a kid, but then I learned it was Peppard.
Salt and pepper.
Robert Vaughn.
Yes.
And this was the Magnificent Seven in space, is what it was, right? Mm-hmm. And Peppard was that, Robert Vaughn was that cold killer, the assassin.
Whose name was Gelt.
Gelt.
What,
hey,
what a
Gelt.
Great sci-fi name.
I think it's like, no, forget it. Who else is in that movie? John Saxon.
John Saxon.
Plays the bad guy. What's his name?
Sador.
Sador.
Another great science fiction
movie. This was one of those, like, everyone had to jump on the bandwagon and do a science fiction movie after Star Wars was such a big hit.
Yeah.
You know, and 3 years later, they're doing Battle Beyond the Stars. one of my favorite character actors is in this movie that I now recollect, who played Dr. Van Gelder. No, in fact... It wasn't. He didn't play Dr. Van Gelder. Maybe he did play Dr. Van Gelder. My name is Dr. Van Gelder. In the Star Trek episode, I'm going to recall the name. Maybe I'll come back to it just to avoid boring people to death. Morgan Woodward, who also had a role in Dallas, I think, but did a ton of TV. Morgan Woodward. Famous pockmarked. Oh, the thing you'd know him most from is Cool Hand Luke. He plays the guy with no eyes, the guy with the mirrored sunglasses.
He's still with us, by the way. Born in 1925.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. And I think he's actually done some stuff.
He worked in Millennium. He was in Millennium and the X-Files.
He was great in Millennium. He was in Iron Lung.
He was in T.J. Hooker. Gotta love that.
Oh, hey, man. Anybody that's been in T.J. Hooker is in line for low budget.
He also has the character name in Battle Beyond the Stars is Kamen of the Lambda Zone.
Yes, Kamen of the Lambda Zone. Now, Morgan Woodward did... the reason I go on about him is because I love the guy so much. But most of his career, 95% of his career was in TV.
Yeah.
And he's been around forever.
Simon, he's done everything.
Bonanza and stuff like that. The last guy I can think of is the very famous acting teacher, very awesome character actor, Jeff Corey. Jeff Corey, we've talked about him before on the show. He's fantastic in a great movie with Rock Hudson. Yes, Rock Hudson, directed by John Frankenheimer. The very, very underlooked, very incredible movie, Seconds.
Wow. He has 217 credits, Jeff Corey.
Yeah, he's a fantastic. Is he passed away?
Yeah, 2002.
Yeah, that's a shame. He was a wonderful guy. So how many did I get? Six, seven?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
All right, cool.
Yeah.
I got seven.
Well done.
I'm happy.
What's her name?
I have a question, though. Maybe you can answer this. You maybe have a question. You can answer this. Why is George Peppard always wearing gloves? In everything
he wears gloves in Breakfast at Tiffany's.
I think he does.
Or the Carpetbaggers. No, he does wear gloves. He wears driving gloves in the Carpetbaggers.
He's got big old cowboy gloves on in Battle Beyond the Stars. He's got he's A-team, got the black gloves.
I can tell you that it's not a James Coburn arthritic busted knuckles reason.
He has warts. He had a lot of warts.
The guy just likes to wear gloves. What? He's in the Blue Max, too. I love that movie.
But that's it. Yeah, I've always seen him wearing gloves.
All right, well, cool. I think we got... He threw me Sword and the Sorcerer a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, it was a couple months ago now.
Yeah, we were for our first ones.
I went into that time vortex, which was Dark Country. I felt like I stepped off the planet one day, and I came back the next, but suddenly 2 months of time had disappeared. All right, well, thanks, everybody.
Bye.